Hi everyone, thank you Dr. Green for the introduction. As Dr. Green mentioned, my name is Miriam Khan. I will be presenting today on understanding healthcare-associated mortality, the case of elective colectomy surgery. And this presentation is the outcome of research I did as an MPH student at the University of Michigan under the guidance of Dr. Samantha Hendren. Jim Kubis and Dr. Daryl Campbell also assisted with this research. I have no relationships to disclose. I'd like to start off by a little bit of background on what a colectomy is. A colectomy is a surgical resection of any extent of the large intestine, and it's typically done via an abdominal incision, and in the lower right-hand corner you can see incision scars because surgeons went in through the abdomen. And it's typically performed for a variety of conditions, but namely colon cancer and diverticulitis. Oops. So why is research necessary into colectomy mortality? Public health really prioritizes its research on patient safety, and interestingly enough, more than 100,000 patients die each year from complications of medical care. And so how does that tie into colectomies? Well, colectomies are one of the most common surgical procedures. 258,000 colectomies are performed each year, and they comprise over 10% of the total operative volume in general surgery. There's a 4.3% death rate, which, when you compare with other common surgical procedures such as hysterectomies, hysterectomy mortality rate is 0.001%. When you compare that with colectomies, it's 4.3%, so it's really high. Most of the studies that have looked at colectomy mortality have used administrative or single institution data, which means that higher quality evidence is needed to understand this phenomenon and then design strategies to decrease mortality. So our objective was to identify the variables associated with mortalities in elective colectomy patients. We wanted to identify 1, risk factors, and 2, postoperative events. And so moving into our methods, this was a population-based retrospective cohort study. The study setting was the Michigan Surgical Quality Collaborative, or the MSQC, and the data was derived from 2005 to 2010. And the MSQC is a collaborative quality improvement organization which is comprised of 34 Michigan hospitals, which includes both academic and community settings. I think this map is a great illustration of how rich and how high quality data that was used in our study. As you can see, the hospitals are all throughout the state of Michigan, and again, they were both academic and community hospitals. And so, more on the methods. In terms of data collection, trained abstractors prospectively collected detailed clinical information. Detailed clinical information included patient demographics, comorbidities, functional status, lab values, diagnoses, and operation performed, as well as 30-day postoperative outcomes. And then there was a case selection algorithm designed to avoid selection bias. So the first 40 cases of every 8-day cycle was selected. And so because our goal was to understand cases with unexpected high mortality, we really wanted to have a low-risk cohort. So we set some exclusions, which were cases where the patient's condition was defined to be emergency, or if the patient coming to get the colectomy had preoperative sepsis, or if the patient was categorized as life-threatening at surgery. And so we did 2 separate analyses. In the first analysis, we analyzed patient factors and surgical factors in a univariate analysis. And those that were significant were put into a multiple regression model. And then we did another analysis looking at postoperative events and using univariate analyses and multiple regression, multiple logistic regression again. And so we found that from a sample of 5,985 patients, the mean age was 64 years, and most had surgery for neoplasms or diverticular disease. And 93 died, which is a death rate of 1.55%, which is really reflective of our low-risk selection criteria. And just as a reminder, so we did two separate analyses. So we looked at 90 patient factors and surgical factors and put them in a univariate analysis. And those that were significant were then put into a multiple logistic regression model. And those found to be significant were older age, ascites, disseminated cancer, hypertension, weight loss, dependent functional status at baseline, and indication for surgery. And then in our second analysis, we looked at postoperative events in, using a univariate analysis, and those that were significant, the factors, the events that were significant were put into a multiple logistic regression model, and those that were found to be significant were the following: myocardial infarction, sepsis, bleeding that required blood transfusion, and pneumonia. And I should mention that 54% of all patients who died had one or more of these conditions. And so we found that patterns of patient factors may indeed predict healthcare mortality, and demographics, functional status, and comorbidities may also predict healthcare mortality. And lastly, there's a strong association between death and four postoperative complications. That was the previous chart you saw on the previous slide. And so our conclusions were that identification of high-risk patients may allow for better selection to reduce surgical mortality, for example, to avoid surgery in the setting of ascites, disseminated cancer, weight loss, and low functional status. And then also, efforts to prevent a small number of specific complications may have a high impact on mortality rates, particularly in cases of MI, sepsis, bleeding, and pneumonia. And furthermore, a small number of complications are associated with most of the deaths in the study, which suggests that focused efforts to decrease rates of these specific complications may affect mortality rates. And through this mechanism, healthcare quality and safety initiatives, such as the MSQC organization that was the setting of the study, may hold the promise of positively affecting public health. And thank you.
Potential for PCORI, one thing. And secondly, I didn't hear too much about patient-oriented, which I thought was the essence of it, which is not necessarily going in the same place as comparative effective.
Yes. Actually, no, I'm really not skeptical. I guess you could say I'm skeptical in the sense that there's a large portion of their goal that is supposed to include patients, and patients aren't coming to the meetings. They're actually based here in Washington, D.C., and there have not been any patient attendance at the patient-centered meetings. So I think that they're going to miss a portion that they're going after, but the clinical research, obviously, comparative effectiveness research, is what they're going at, and they don't necessarily need to have patient input to guide those studies. That was what the patient input was supposed to be, was to kind of guide studies, talk about outcomes and actual satisfaction. So I really am not skeptical. I think that there will need to be some improvements as they grow, but I think there is a potential for them to do great work. I guess the point of this conversation is, in any policy, we need to make sure that we look at what might happen, so we know how to interact. And I believe your second question was on patient-centered, exactly in the sense of, I don't know if you can clarify.
In terms of proposals coming forward, mm-hmm. that's a huge challenge for us.
Absolutely.
Because we have a lot of cottage industries that have been created over 50 years that would suggest that we don't really need a patient orientation here. Let's just do what we think, we being the establishment, is in the best interest of the patients. It's kind of an old-fashioned patronizing attitude about if you only took your meds, you might be a lot better. And so these oversimplifications have gone up over the years. I thought that was part of this Macquarie effort, as challenging as it is.
Sure. I think it is. I mean, and idealistically, I think it would be. And even not idealistically, I think pragmatically it would be. Their goal is to not only get patient input in designing before they design studies, but also to get business people and pharmaceuticals and doctors and a whole wide variety of voices as they go forth to plan these studies. So I'm hoping I'm not coming across as being entirely skeptical of the organization, because I think they have a great opportunity to do great work. However, I would have to say, as it stands right now, the studies that have come forth, like this past one, would have been made and supported without a lot of patient input.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for your question.
Do you think this model that you presented, that you talked about, can be replicated in other countries? And if so, which country? And also, or what characteristics should a city or a village have to succeed to find success in something like this partnership, this model that you have in Delhi?
So I do see this model being replicated in other areas that do require high quality care for HIV patients. In terms of countries that would benefit, there are several countries in several countries in Africa, such as Botswana. I was thinking of Swaziland, areas that are highly or has a high prevalence of HIV. In terms of what it takes in order to have a successful model, you definitely need the commitment of the people. What makes Museum Fulo Clinic so successful is because you're getting commitment from the PHRU, which is the perinatal HIV unit and part of the largest hospital in South Africa, willing to support such a model and getting patients to go to the clinic.
Did you think there was anything they could do to make it more financially viable?
Well, the thing is that with the financial viability, the infrastructure part, 50% of it goes to personnel. So since the infrastructure is now set up, it's just a matter of getting more patients to come into the clinic. And it's more or less over time getting the word out, letting people know that this clinic provides high quality care, then you would be able to see the increase in terms of, more or less the fact that the revenue would come in and would show that there's some growth.
But I thought some of the pressure side was high for testing the lab tests. Mm-hmm. Did you think it's high, or
with the laboratory tests that I cited?
$300 something.
So the 350 blood tests, that was for the private sector, and that's what the private sector was charging for their patients. For the clinic itself, with blood work included, they were charging patients $14.
And were they having
Well, the thing is that they also outsourced it to laboratories that were accepting it at a reduced rate, too. And part of it is subsidized by PEPFAR funding.
What's the turnaround rate for those? Because, I mean, I know that the private is just from personal experience. So. private 350, which I think it's high as well. I think that might be a cancel for 12 months.
350 for 6 months of the test work.
That turnaround rate is pretty quickly for consistent.
Mm-hmm.
You get it in a day or two.
Mm-hmm.
What's the $14? What's the rate? Do you know the turnaround time?
24 hours to 48 hours.
One more question. I'm running. Not to grill you, mind. I happen to research this in Istanbul, and Istanbul,
mm-hmm.
and similar stuff. So it's interesting. I've got it right now. Back to the personnel, 50, I believe it's 51%.
Yes, 2%.
I thought that was pretty high for personnel, only because claims that I've seen obviously they're not targeted in the HIV, aspects of healthcare now, which says a general medical thing, but they typically don't have that big of a staff, and they put most of their money towards patient care mm-hmm. items. So even reducing the price tag of the drugs or the services provided. How is that working? Or can you kind of give the background model, the theory of why 52%, why the most money going to the doctors and not to the patients?
So I seem to hear you say that they're over capacity. So that if they that they wouldn't need to hire more people, but if they got twice as many clients, that the people they have could serve twice.
Exactly. So the PHRU unit is affiliated to one of the biggest hospitals in South Africa. And so we have staff members and physicians devoting part of their FTE to the Zuzi Mpilo clinic. And in that respect, we have staff members, I think about 20 staff members hired. And it's also located in the city, so it's in Joburg, which is different from rural areas, where rural areas you don't have as many providers, and in some cases providers tend to be more focused in the city.
So the personnel also includes office payment, like real estate and all that stuff as well?
Well, the personnel is just for salaries.
Salary.
The operational cost includes the rent and utility maintenance.
I just wanted to know if they have a computer.
They do have a computer.
So they manage to keep their records pretty effectively that way, right?
Yes. They have a database.
That's true.
I wanted to ask about the colonal colectomy study. We recently did some work on age and colonoscopy because there are a lot of physicians who are very concerned about referring their elderly patients for screening colonoscopy. And so we were looking for models and work that had been done looking at older patients and how to handle a variety of conditions. And there are these actuarial charts that show, the people who were the 25% healthiest, how long they lived more years of life they have compared to those who were within the 75th percentile healthiest, and then by the number of comorbidities that they have, and then looking at the actual complication rates for those who have colonoscopy. And we found that for those who are healthiest at the older ages, who have the lesser diagnoses, the complications are not necessarily any greater than a younger cohort. And it was really more based on numbers of comorbidities and frailty, functional status, and so forth, which determine whether they were more likely to be at risk for the procedure. So I thought that was kind of interesting, especially in light of what you were finding about the colectomy and some similar conclusions.
Right. I think a lot of studies looking into colectomies and who is at risk and who's not is really preliminary right now. And so it's reassuring to know that there are similar findings out there.
Is that work going to be presented to the practicing community within that area in Michigan? Where are you going to be taking those results?
Our hope is that it would be generalizable beyond the regional level, so beyond Michigan.
But as it stands, we were hoping that once we wrap everything up, it would be generalizable to Michigan.
One of the things that, you know, we have this colorectal cancer screening program in Maryland, is how much preoperative evaluation you have to do before you do colonoscopy and before you get people to the OR if they need something done. I mean, all this stuff that the uninsured becomes kind of an issue. So all these people had insurance, do you think?
Some of them did, some of them didn't.
Because, I mean, the question of stress testing and later having a MRI, you know, that kind of thing comes up a lot when we're trying to deal with those folks. So I wasn't sure that was a factor. And the other thing was the use of antibiotics at the time of surgery is pretty standard now. You know if everybody got antibiotics for 24 hours or something for abdominal surgery to avoid postoperative infections. I mean, Medicare is going to kill you if you have a postoperative infection. I would think you might die too, but.
I am assuming that there was medication during the time of surgery.
It's pretty standard care.
Right.
It's the same then and now.
Right.
But I think it's not every surgeon that does it, but somehow it's probably not.
Right.
What do you think about the stress testing and stuff like that for cardiac?
Well, that's really interesting because that's up and coming. That's an up and coming aspect to collecting mortality rates, and what they found is that patients who have hypertension or uncontrolled hypertension or some cardiovascular condition don't respond as well to things happening during surgery, surgical techniques, or physiological reactions to the surgery itself. And so post-surgery, they are more at risk to die from colectomy surgery, but not necessarily related to, not necessarily that the outcome was only surgery, but it was their pre-existing heart condition or hypertension.
So one more question. Do you know if the people with thyroid radiculitis were the same as well as the people that had cancer? Or because it would seem that there might be a greater infection risk for those folks.
Right. I'm not sure about that.
12%.
So. Question for me. So I found your presentation sort of depressing.
So
I guess the question that I have is, what can we do to try to knit together all these things that are out there that don't talk to each other and collectively seem to be waste of money?
Well, thank you for that question. I wouldn't go on so much to say that's a waste of money, but I think historically funding has happened through different streams. So you have funding from SAMHSA, you have funding from HRSA, you have funding from the local health department, you have funding from local.
You now have dual eligible projects going on in Massachusetts with trying to the Medicare and Medicaid funding.
So all of that leads to different reporting requirements and the different standards that agencies need to adhere to. I would say that there is an increasing recognition that this siloed funding does not work. So for instance, in Baltimore, Ryan White Part A has meetings that are separate from Ryan White Part B, and many agencies get funding from the same, get funding from both of those programs, and often their meetings are like a day apart. So now what Ryan White Part A is trying to do is, you know, coordinate with the Ryan White Part B so that they know who's getting funding from both of them, where is, duplication of funding happening, and set up having more local connections among themselves to figure out where they could work together. I don't have a simple solution for funding cuts that seem to underlie a lot of barriers to collaboration. At one hand, agencies are being forced to collaborate more because there's this funding cut, but then at the same time, funding cut is what is preventing them from trying to collaborate. So, sorry, no easy answers to that, but I think doing studies like this is good because one agency does know what it thinks and what its barriers are, but to, you know, present a unified picture of this is what different agencies think and this is what the local health department thinks is at least a first step in initiating a dialogue on how this problem could be addressed, and hopefully they would take it up and some of it. Thank you.
I have a question.
And different ways that is operationalized. So for instance, you can do a network analysis, and the basis for the network analysis would be client referrals and joint funding. So my study is actually a mixed method study. I presented findings from the qualitative part, but in the quantitative part, I'm actually mapping the patterns of collaboration. So who's sending clients to who, who's referring, who's receiving clients. So those are two different networks. But you have joint funding, if you have administrative linkages. And there is a body of literature that says that client referrals are actually not the best way to operationalize collaboration because they really happen on a personal basis. I work in agency A, I know Sunny who works in agency B, so I have a relationship with him, so I will refer my client, but does that mean that the agencies really have a relationship? But if you have administrative linkages, such as receiving joint funding, are being written into each other's grant, that is a better way to operationalize collaboration. I hope that answers.
I mean, I was thinking that the at the end you said that you have to really step back and look at what the whole need of the city is. I mean, and it also includes in the HIV business this question, which I've sort of, you know, beat the drums about housing for these folks, which means broadening the whole question of how you approach substance abuse and housing. Maybe solve some of the problems that the agencies are struggling with. When they're struggling with case management that can't solve problems, if you can solve some of those bigger problems, you could then maybe have a more efficient collaboration. So I think there is room for a lot more. I mean, when HUD and CDC did do collaborative studies on healthcare and housing, it was kind of innovative, and it wasn't that long ago. So in Baltimore, this is where they looked at it. So it seems like there could be some work from those agencies to try to help pull some of these things together, like you're saying, get some of the people on top to really make it happen. Because when you're scrambling at the bottom, it's really, really frustrating. I thought you captured it very well. The quotes were great.
No, that's exactly right. So for instance, in Baltimore especially, we have relatively more funding for HIV needs than many other cities in the United States. There's also anecdotal evidence that people actually migrate to Baltimore. To be able to take advantage of these services. So
coming up from Alabama.
So we do have the. So you have. No, I mean, this is all part of the discussion. So there are agencies that provide that have, you know, traditionally focused on housing. And now many of them, like Healthcare for the Homeless, are coming up with these one-stop centers where not only do you serve homeless clients, but you take care of substance abuse needs, and you take care of nutritional assistance, and you can, you know, they have certain dates when providers from other agencies come in, so clients know that this is a safe place where they can do things. And for homeless people especially, mental health issues are an important comorbidity that occurs, and Healthcare for the Homeless, they have a very approachable, a very non-intimidating way of working with people. So, you know, they even have rooms where you could just come and do painting and not do anything else. So a homeless client with mental health issues may, over time, come to know of you as the nice lady who lets me paint, and then, you know, they might let you talk to them further, and then that is an entry into care. So we do have integrated systems that are coming up, but of course, there will always be a need for a greater collaboration.
Do you have a chance to ask Al a question? I want to ask Al. Al, you're hiding back there.
Yeah. I'll stand up.
Can you tell us what you really think?
Yeah.
This pediatric stuff. I mean, it looks like there really has been a long history of this studying and the training. us over the last period of time with the narcotics people, who convinced us that you should segue from cancer pain management into low back pain management with oxycodone and all that stuff, and totally distorted our practice for the last 20 years, which we're now trying to regroup from.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wondered if you thought this was going the same way.
You know what? I don't know. I think that's it's hard to tell. These are just trends, and you know, for instance, the way that the warning label for antidepressants came out from the FDA for suicidality changed the impacted practice substantially for dispensing prescribing antidepressants in younger children because of the higher suicidality rate. I mean, after that happened, the prescription just dropped. But is that a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, we can argue that yes, it's probably a good thing because maybe they didn't need to be on it. But at the same time, what if they did need to be on it, and they're subtherapeutic? We're not giving them the therapy they need. I think there's still a lot of data that needs to go out there. I think one of the larger hurdles are like diagnosing to see where these patients are and what treatments really do work for those diagnoses. I think it's just hard to get studies in the pediatric population.
It seems like it takes a long time.
Yeah.
If you wait to see how they come out as an adult,
yeah,
and you're treating them then, you have to have more longitudinal studies, right?
Yeah. But that's the problem. Just getting, the pediatric population in those types of studies for so long and keeping track of them, I believe is difficult.
There was also, in my mind, there was a change in the demographics between white and minority groups, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you restate that?
Yeah, so basically there was, what our data showed was that there was less white race ethnicity over the years and more in the minorities, such as Hispanic and Asian and other mixed minorities. And that may be due to just more awareness, maybe due to actual just census changes. We haven't really looked too far into it, but we do notice.
Maybe it's confounded with Medicaid and socioeconomic.
Well, that's where we're going at, and we haven't looked, we haven't compared that with the actual pay type yet. We're still working at the, what is their payment method versus public, private, or other unknown, and we're still looking at that and to see, where these visits are coming from and how they're paying for it. And, once we get a better handle of that, we can see whether or not those demographics match up.
Well, I think we have to stop.